Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are in Genesis chapter 6 today. Genesis 6, and hopefully a good ways into Genesis chapter 6. Getting into the flood narratives of Genesis 6 through 9. We won't quite make it all the way through chapter 9, but we'll do some things that will set up later portions of the book. Maybe we'll begin to talk about covenants in the Bible. We'll see if we get to that. Of course, we've left off with the contrast in Genesis between Cain's line and the line of Seth that comes from Adam to Seth. Cain being the ungodly line, get that right, and Seth being the godly line demonstrated in Genesis 4 and 5. And now we come to the subject of the flood. And we begin with just thinking about the reason for the flood. I'm going to read Genesis 6, 1 through 8, just because we're going to talk about these verses quite a bit. They're verses that have some debate in them in terms of how to interpret them, and I'm not going to try to fully settle that this morning, but give some thoughts to how you might think through some of these questions. Genesis 6, beginning in verse number 1 down through verse number 8, says, "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply in the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, all of whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years. There were giants, or Nephilim, on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man, that it was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Now, these verses here in verses 1 through 8, and here's your first blank, they are transitional verses that move the narrative from the end of the second Toledot. This is one of the few times I'm going to use a Hebrew word in here. The end of the second Toledot to the third. When we see that word Toledot, just refresh your mind. This goes back quite a few weeks. That's like when we see this is the genealogy of, or this is the history of. That's the term that we're using there. So we're coming to the end of the first, the second one of those, and moving to the third. So they bring together the two lines of the surviving sons of Adam and Eve, Cain and Seth, and also the growing effects of the fall. So as we think about the narrative as a whole of Genesis, we're moving from God's created everything good, mankind has fallen, we are seeing the effects of the fall in Cain's line, and now we're really seeing what sin does by the time we get to Genesis chapter 6. The whole earth was full of violence, the whole earth was full of people whose every thought was towards evil. And so we're transitioning to see what has happened in God's goodness to man's rebellion and the full effects of it. Now, we are introduced to two groups of people, letter B. They're the sons of God and the daughters of men. Now, the identity of these two groups is one of those things that has been debated in church history and even before that in Jewish history for well over 2,000 years. Okay, so there's questions as to who we're talking about here. And if you read any commentary, they're going to have lengthy pages in trying to figure this out. And there are three main options. Each one of these have kind of wrinkles and variations, but we're going to focus on the three main ones here for a few moments. And I'm not going to ultimately settle this question, but I will try to give you a direction, or at least where I think that we should land, although you have room for disagreement on this one, because Christians have disagreed about this for nearly the entirety of church history. So if we think we're going to fix it in this room today in the middle of nowhere, Sunrise, Minnesota, we're fooling ourselves. But there are three main options. The first is that the sons of God refer to aristocrats that are human judges or powerful rulers. And this view is primarily a Jewish view, although some Christians have adopted it. So primarily Jewish in origin. So you'll find rabbis in the Middle Ages and before that have held this view, but a few Christians have as well. The second view is that the sons of God refer to fallen angels who intermarried with women, the daughters of men, to produce a perverse mix angel-human race. Okay, so that's the second view. And some of you have heard of that, and some of you are looking at that and going, what? Yeah, this is actually well represented in church history and even today. The third view is that the sons of God refer to the godly line of Seth, while the daughters of men refer to the children born to women, or specifically born to children born to the ungodly line of Cain. So that's the third option there. Now, this question does have, in some sense, real significance, and in another sense, not much significance at all. So I just want to start with that right away. The real significance comes from the idea that clearly the author, Moses, attributes some measure of God's judgment upon the earth to the sons of men and sons of God and daughters of men coming together. In other words, it is, in some sense, important to understanding why the flood happened. Okay, so that makes the question important. It's very clear. Everybody agrees on that when you read it. In another sense, and I'll say this later in the notes, no significant major doctrine rests on this question. Okay, so in the end of the day, this is not a question that should needlessly divide Christians. So no major doctrine, but it does affect the flow of the narrative here in Genesis. So let's just think about these three options for just a few moments together. First of all, let's think about the sons of God as aristocrats. And here's just a couple of very broad arguments, and we're not doing like a detailed exegetical analysis of every one of these arguments. We're just giving some broad overviews, and you can think about them on your own. This view suggests that the word Elohim, that's the word for God in Sons of God. Many of you have heard the name for God, Elohim. That the name Elohim is used occasionally of human rulers. And for instance, I list there one example, Psalm 82, verses 1 and 6 and 7, seem to use the term Elohim to refer to mighty, powerful judges and rulers on the earth. Okay, so there is that. So they note that. They also would say that down in verse number 4, when it talks about the Nephilim, effectively, I think if you have an ESV, does it actually use the term Nephilim there? Does anybody have that? Am I correct on that? Okay. All right, if you have a New King James, King James, I'm not sure what the NIV does or New American Standard does. They'll use the term giants. But even if you look at... If you look at the ESV probably has a footnote that says in the bottom of that Nephilim. That's literally the word Nephilim. And so when we use that term Nephilim, we're talking about that word giants, depending on your translation there. And so this view says that these Nephilim or giants are not children of the sons of God and the daughters of men, but are contemporaries. So they're just people in that era. They further note that the account of Cain's genealogy indicates the organization of cities, polygamy, and violence. And you say, where do you get that from? Well, if you go back into Genesis 4, some of Cain's children build cities. And furthermore, you think about his great-great-great-great-grandson somewhere in there, Lamech. Lamech is the guy who took two wives. Remember we met him a couple of weeks ago? He took two wives, and then on top of that, he killed a young man for wounding him. Okay? And so what this view says is if you look at the flow of the narrative, there's an indication that there are these mighty, powerful, aristocratic rulers who have brought the earth to violence. So the focus of the judgment is on the evil nature of these rulers on the earth. So that's kind of the sum of this view. But there is a reason why most Christians have not taken this view, and I just note a couple of these. The idea of the sons of God as aristocrats fails in two ways there. This is my opinion, and most would be the least likely option, although it's not without merit. And the first is that the broader context does not speak of a few aristocratic, powerful leaders. For instance, the genealogies of Cain and Seth are in the context, and Seth's genealogy does not indicate that only powerful leaders are in view. This one was born. But even more important is that when we look at Genesis 6:5, and then a bunch of verses after this as well, it indicates that the whole of humanity, it is the whole of humanity that was wicked and not a select few men or women. So it's the whole earth was full of violence. Everyone was like this, not just a few powerful aristocratic leaders. Okay, so this isn't an impossible view, but I think it's more unlikely. Now, I'm moving past that one just because that's a minority view, but you will find it if you do a study of Genesis. Second, trying to figure out who are these sons of God, and that could be this: the sons of God are fallen angels. This view suggests that the sons of God is a reference to divine or heavenly beings, which are in contrast to the daughters of men, which are earthly and terrestrial beings. Okay, so the sons of God, these are angelic, divine, heavenly beings, daughters of men. And you just think about men, lower the earth, God up above. So that they note that contrast there. They would then say that the Nephilim, or giants, are the product of an angel and a human, and therefore unnatural beings. The phrase sons of God is in fact used of angels in Job 1:6. And there are other texts, by the way, that use similar-like language that could indicate that the phrase sons of God would refer to angelic creatures. Furthermore, the New Testament text of 1 Peter 3, 2 Peter 2, 4, and Jude 6 may also support this view. In fact, let's just have these verses read for us. Is there somebody who can read for us 1 Peter 3, 19 through 20, who's got that for us here? Sarah, and then is there someone who can do 2 Peter 2, verse 4? Scott, thank you. And then last, Jude 6. Thank you. All right. So 1 Peter 3, 2 Peter 2, and Jude 6. So these are texts that are said to have referenced this idea of angelic creatures on the earth. All right, let's start with 1 Peter 3, 19 through 20.
By which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water.
So this is a less likely option, but people will say that the spirits in prison could refer to these angelic fallen angel creatures. Furthermore, if you get down in the rest of 1 Peter 3, there seems to be some sort of idea of Christ being ruler over all the powers, the angelic powers, on in heaven and on earth. So that's a less likely one, but the stronger cases are in 2 Peter 2, 4 and Jude 6. So let's hear both of those read.
2:4, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment.
In the context of that, you'll see references to the flood as well, and so that's the context of that. Jude 6 is a similar one.
And I remind you of angels who did not stay within the limits of authority God gave them, but left the place where they belonged. God had kept them securely chained in prisons of darkness, waiting for the great day of judgment.
Okay, so the argument would be, and again, if you look in the context of Jude 6, you have references to Noah and his flood and also the book of First Enoch. The argument would be that there were angels who were judged initially by God, rebelled against God's judgment, and actually commingled with human beings. Now, you say those verses don't necessarily say that explicitly, and this is actually the last portion of this paragraph is, I think, the most important to understanding where this argument comes from. Proponents of this view also point to the Jewish tradition found in the, this is the fancy word, pseudepigraphal. Pseudo means like fake. Pigraphal, like things that refers to writings. So it's someone who wrote in the name of someone else. You'll sometimes see that term if you read a commentary. And so First Enoch was not actually written by Enoch, but it was an ancient Jewish document. It sometimes gets lumped into the Apocrypha, if you know that term. And so First Enoch is this ancient document, and in it, First Enoch, which is probably somewhere around the 2nd century B.C., so, you know, 100 to 200 B.C., that range, First Enoch interprets the Genesis 6 story in this light of saying that it was fallen angels who intermarried with women and produced these, you know, quasi-alien human life forms. And the key is that if you look in Jude, Jude quotes First Enoch in context. And so they're saying that the angels that did not keep their original estate, their place that was reserved, rebelled against God and did this atrocity. And therefore, that is one of the reasons that judgment falls upon the earth. This is an old Jewish tradition, but also you will find a number of early Christian authors in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So we're talking very close to the time of the apostles who held this view. And that includes, I think, Clement holds this view. Irenaeus, I think, holds this view. So these are some pretty early reputable Christian teachers that hold this. So it's not a crazy idea, okay? And so this would be saying, in essence, here's one of the reasons God brought judgment upon the earth. The humanity allowed this to happen, and God judges them. We should also note that it's not crazy to think that in the history of humanity, people have tried to have inappropriate contact with fallen angels. Okay? Now, in the Western culture that we have at least lived in up to this point, that has largely been rejected, although today people are opening themselves up increasingly to occultism and all of the demonic world. In much of the world, though, this idea of saying that people would try to do something like this, they would go, oh yeah, we'd believe that. All right, you know, the spirit world and actual physical connections with them in some level is a reality for at least many people throughout human history, including much of the non-Western world that is around us today. Now, I ultimately don't hold this view, but it is not an illegitimate view. There are many, many Christians who hold this. There are some difficulties, though, with the view, as there are actually difficulties in all of these views. First of all, nothing in the context has indicated an angelic heavenly host of beings up to this point in the Genesis narrative. The closest we get to is we have the cherubim who's guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden. So this would be like a brand new introduction of an idea into the narrative of Genesis. Secondly, it seems that the rest of Genesis 6, 1 through 8 focuses on the judgment of humanity, not angels. So the rest of the emphasis is humans are wicked. Humans are wicked. And if you look in First Enoch, a lot of the judgment is emphasized upon those angels. But the rest of Genesis 6 doesn't indicate that. Letter C, also, there's no biblical evidence elsewhere that angels can procreate. Now, I've listed for you Matthew 22:30. This is the text where Jesus says, you know, he's asked about, you know, if a man dies and he's leaves a widow, and then she remarries his brother, and he dies, and there, you know, there's, she's got seven husbands, they're all dead, you know, sad story, right? We get to the end of seven, and in heaven, this Pharisees, Sadducees, can't remember which group, they ask him, which of the men will be her husband in heaven, essentially, in the eternal state? And Jesus says, you err, okay? You've got it all wrong. He said, we don't marry, and we're not given in marriage in that time. He said, instead, he said, we're like the angels of God. Okay? Now, that does not say that angels can't procreate, but it at least should give us pause to say that seems to be a blessing of marriage is procreation. And so Jesus says we're angels don't do marriage stuff. It would seem to indicate that they would not procreate either. But properly speaking, somebody who holds the sons of God as fallen angels will say it only says they don't marry. It doesn't say that they can't procreate. So that would be what they would push back on. Furthermore, another significant difficulty is that the New Testament text used to support this view, 1 Peter, 2 Peter 2, and Jude 6, must be viewed in conjunction with extra-biblical literature such as 1 Enoch. In other words, they're only clear if the interpreter knows something about the non-canonical book of 1 Enoch. Now, this is actually particularly relevant when it comes to the books of 2 Peter and Jude. One of the things that's interesting in the book of 2 Peter is it is written primarily towards Gentile Christians. And if you do the timeline of when they receive the letter of 2 Peter, they're in the region of Asia Minor, much of which would be in modern Turkey today. And if you do a construction of the timeline of when the gospel came to Turkey and when it actually got to all of those places in Asia Minor, we're probably talking a period of 10 to 15 years between when the gospel first came there and when the book of 2 Peter was actually delivered to them. And one of the questions that you have to ask, or I should say, back that up, when the book of 1 Peter came to them, and one of the questions that you have to ask is, in a 10 to 15 year period, could people who are not Jewish individuals not only know well the Genesis account in Genesis 6, but also know well the book of 1 Enoch and make the connection to say that Genesis 6 is referring to fallen angels? That's a very condensed argument. If you want to see a fuller one, I actually wrote a paper that addresses this topic. And if you want to get into the weeds, you can ask me for it. In other words, the timeline for people to actually receive this is really condensed and compressed. I think it's unlikely. Having said that, if you believe it, great, because if you had talked to me, about 13 years ago, I would have agreed with you. So this is an area where I've actually changed my position and further study of Scripture. So there's my spiel on that. You do with it what you wish. Third view is that the sons of God are godly men. Sons of God are godly men. This view notes that chapters 4 and 5 demonstrate the contrast between the lines of Cain and Seth, with one being wicked and the other godly. Genesis 6, 1 through 8 demonstrate that these two lines intermarry and bring about great wickedness. You know, in other words, it's the good girl who got married to the bad guy, and she has thrown off all of her morals, and she's living now in wickedness right along with him. And so they're saying this is what happened. There were a godly remnant, but they forsook that godliness and let their guard down. Furthermore, this view would also note that the flood narrative occurs within the genealogy of Seth, at least this first part, and this genealogy does not conclude till after the flood. Beyond this, they would note that the moral decline of the godly line of Seth demonstrates the need for the flood judgment. And finally, they would say that I would say that the sons of God could be translated simply as godly sons. Of course, this view also has some difficulties. one of the strongest is that early Jewish and early Christian traditions demonstrate that this view, this view was not widely held close to the time of the apostles. And so, in other words, if you look at the historical church record, the sons of God as fallen angels has a far greater representation among early Christians than this letter C. And furthermore, even though I just tried to knock the whole viewing of those passages in 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude as saying I don't think they fit the biblical evidence, that there is actually a strong case there to be made. It's not altogether weak. Of the three views, the most likely are the sons of God as fallen angels and the sons of God as godly men. The interpreter will have to decide, but thankfully, no important Bible doctrine rests upon this question. Yes, sir. And I'll get to your dad after that. So,
I have heard of one other view. Correct me if this kind of falls under one of the other ones, but I heard one where they basically argue that the sons of God and the daughters of men is actually just dealing with men on the earth who are just taking wives of anyone whom they please, just a complete and utter lack of restraint when dealing with the concept of marriage, because particularly in that phrase, they took wives of just without restraint, pretty much.
So that view is brought to bear often under both the Jewish interpretation, letter A, and also letter C, the sons of God, daughters of men being godly line. You'll see that often falling under that. I'm not sure that I've seen someone make that just completely independent, but if you have, I'd be interested to know that. That is possible in both cases. The trouble is that if you look at the phrase, whoever they chose, there's debate as to how to translate that. Does that mean they're just taking wives? Or it could be that, again, that you have these commingling of lineages of Seth and Cain. So there is a bunch of Hebrew grammar stuff that honestly is stretching beyond my pay grade there, but commentators and Bible teachers will address that one. But that is a represented view.
One of the concerns I have with the sons of God, meaning fallen angels, is the fact, or to my understanding, there's no blurring of the lines between the idea. For instance, nowhere in Scripture during the creation account does it say that angels were created as part of the world's created order. Then God makes a statement that they reproduce after their own kind. What's interesting about this is that that's not borne out in an obedience level. In other words, humans can't go procreate with some other kind. They are literally the ordaining is that they will reproduce after their own kind, meaning human. Angels are created outside of that complete situation, and so I would see this as angels having the ability to override God's creative power on this earth and his created order, saying that things would have to follow the design that he gave it. If they can override that, that actually creates a serious theological problem, and I think it creates a real problem for our approach to God and his power. So I would say that it cannot be that. Because God's natural order and the way that he doesn't succumb to somebody else's design or somebody else's will, and in this case it would have to almost. It would say that angels have the ability to override God's command, and I don't think that's possible.
Yeah, I think that there could be some pushback to that, but I would tend to agree with you. So, yeah.
The closest I could get with it, I think I could get to that viewpoint, is that demonic forces in the world had taken over human individuals where they were the driving force behind a behavior, but certainly not outside of the created order.
Yeah. Well, if we look, the great theme through Genesis and Exodus and all those is that they are not to intermarry between the the people and the nation of God until, you know, you look at Esau. He went and married outside of the family, and that caused all kinds. And it's just that theme that runs through. So you'd almost have to stay with the theme that runs through rather than a theme that never is really stated again until maybe we see in Peter and Jude and so.
Yeah, if you didn't hear that, this is also another argument, and I would subscribe to this as well, that says that if you look in the theme of the Pentateuch, there's this constant warning, both in Genesis and Exodus and following, that you're not to, the people of God were not to intermarry with groups who were ungodly. You think about the Jews were, the Israelites were to remain faithful to and marry among their own people. They weren't to take foreign wives among them. And so that theme could be budding actually here in Genesis 6, and it continues on throughout the rest of the. I would say I would call that a strong supporting argument, and I would hold that as well. All right, well, last one, and then we're going to move on from trying to settle this 2,000 plus year debate. All right, so.
So wasn't Jude written before Enoch?
No.
When did you say Enoch was written?
Enoch was probably 1st, 2nd century BC. It's pre-Christ.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. First Enoch is actually a very valuable text for understanding the world of the Jewish mind at the time of Jesus, and also understanding some Jewish interpretive methods. There is value in studying it. It's not a worthless text, and it is very clear that Jude quotes from it. He does that in Jude. But it's... now we're jumping out of Genesis into the rest of, you know, New Testament stuff here at this point. In general, though, unless you've mastered the Bible well, don't bother with First Enoch. Start with the Bible. There's a lot of people that get all excited about reading stuff that's not the Bible before they finish reading the Bible well. Learn the Bible well, then you can learn First Enoch. But it does have value. Yeah. All right. Great questions, great interaction. And I give you full... and free rights to vociferously disagree with me on my conclusions, all right? Okay, letter C, as we continue on in here, these first verses, these transitional verses, we also have the restriction of human life. My spirit shall not always strive with man forever, going to be 120 years. This also creates some interpretive questions that you'll see pages spilled about. Just in general, these first four verses just have of Genesis 6 have quite a few questions with them. First of all, the word strive there, my spirit shall not strive with man, could mean protect or shield. So the idea would be that God in his grace was allowing people to live long lives. And if you look back in Genesis 5, we saw the length of those lives demonstrated. Methuselah lives, he's at 967, am I right on that?
969.
What, 969? Okay, yeah. So he lives a long, long time. And so God was protecting them, graciously allowing them to live a long time. This idea would be that it would be withholding the full force of the curse upon humanity. The word strive could mean remain, number two there. So God's spirit is not going to, the idea is remain with mankind, which would be an indication both of, you could take that one of two ways. You could take it in connection with the next question about the length of someone's life. Or is the 120 years referring to how long it would be before the flood came? So how you take the word strive affects the next question. In both cases, however, the text seems to be indicating that God will not allow mankind to continue in their wickedness. That's the key. He's not going to allow this entire earth violence view to keep happening. A second interpretive question is, what does his day shall be 120 years mean? What does that mean? And as I just referenced, the timeline could refer to how long humanity had before the flood came. That may find support in 1 Peter 3, which could be interpreted as God's spirit preaching through Noah. Also, the timeline of 120 years could refer to how long a human being would live after the flood. This would correspond to the length of Moses' life in Deuteronomy 31 and 34, where Moses is said to have lived to 120 years. Which it's pretty much tops out where we're at in the world. Like, you know, that's about where we're at, you know. And even at that, of course, Psalm 90 tells us that the years of our lives are 80 years and 10, if by reason of strength, they're 80 years, which is actually about average, right? Between 70 and 80 is when most people pass, right? So that's that. This would be the high end of that. So as a note there, both options are acceptable, and many pages of ink have been spilled over how to interpret that, but it is a thing that you'll face if you try to study through Genesis and read any commentary on it. And then you have another difficult question. Who are the Nephilim in verse 4? Nephilim, the giants. This term is difficult to define. It's difficult to define. Some point to Numbers 13:33 and the Nephilim who were in the land of Canaan when the 12 spies spied out the land. Remember that they go in there and they say, there are giants in the land. We can't take over this. God's going to, you know, God's not going to be with us. He's not going to help us. And so some people connect it to that. However, these are likely not referring to the same group since all humanity was destroyed by the flood. The Nephilim of Numbers 13 cannot be descendants of Genesis 6 because everybody died except Noah and his three sons and their wives. So they cannot be the descendants. However, I will note this is not in your notes, is that those who believe that the fallen angels' view is in line say that's also why God commanded that the Israelites destroy all of the Canaanites, is because the angels were doing it again. Okay, so that's a thing, right? But I think that it's a broader term than just a reference to a specific line of people. Others see the Nephilim as defining the era of the sons of God and the daughters of men. Given the long lifespans that are indicated in chapter 5, these individuals were therefore well known. These men would have had extensive opportunity to display their wickedness. So I think that it is a reference to, in some sense, you know, long-living, powerful people who had, in some cases, 700, 800, 900 years to demonstrate how bad they were. And they became well-known for their badness. That's how I would take it. All right, how about the judgment here? Let's see if we can get through this first point quickly. While there is debate on how verses 1 through 4 relate to God's judgment on the earth, verse 5, Genesis 6, 5, clearly teaches that humanity's sinful behavior was the most important factor in God bringing judgment upon the earth. It's the wickedness of mankind. Though the Nephilim were men of renown and thus celebrated, God saw their wickedness as severe. Note the description that their wickedness was great and that their every intent was only evil continually. We often talk about, you know, this is the worst it's ever been in society. No, it's not. If you want my suspicion, is I think that we're going to get to the worst ever in society before the Lord comes. I think you see evidence with, you know, as in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man comes again. But I don't know if I can prove that completely, but this was the worst point in human history. Furthermore, verses 11 through 13 also repeatedly point to the wicked behavior of mankind as the reason for judgment. Let me talk very quickly about God's grief. God was grieved that he made mankind. The statement that God was grieved does not deny the, here's a theological term, impassibility of God. The impassibility of God. When we say that God is impassible, we mean that God cannot be acted on from without, neither can his inner state change for better or worse. What that means in practical terms is that God is not forced by external circumstances to respond or to suffer, including feeling emotions. He is different from us in this. So, you know, you see the ad come along on the television, in the eyes of the angels, you know, and it's got the cute little puppies that are, well, not so cute because they're starving, all right? And it's designed to impress upon you from an outward thing a feeling that you almost can't control. And by the way, they know that it works because people give a lot of money for that, okay? Right? But you can do this with a lot of things, with not just music, but poetry, movies, art. We can sway passions and emotions from external circumstances that we can control, but in some sense, also we know we don't have full control of. We are able to be not manipulated, although we can be that, but even just moved by external forces. The impassibility of God says that God doesn't operate like that. He chooses to respond. He's not forced to respond. So when we say that God was grieved, it's not like a new situation came along and he's like, didn't see that coming, and man, I'm mad about it now. All right, that's not what we mean by in terms of God's being grieved. So we say this, letter B, God's response was to grieve over humanity. His passions were not moved by humanity. His response was to grieve over humanity. His passions were not moved by humanity. And finally, we see God's grace towards Noah. The phrase, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, is an idiom that focuses more upon God than it does Noah. And if you want evidence of that, you can look at Genesis 18:10, 18:3:10, 33, Judges 6:17, and 2 Samuel 15, which you can do on your own time because I am over time and need to be done and get ready for the morning service. So we'll pick it up next week with Noah and his preparation for the flood. Thank you so much. You are dismissed.